You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next on Art Focus, host Joseph Galavan interviews Grace Cook Anderson, curator of Northwest Art at the Portland Art Museum, about The Map Is Not the Territory.
May is Asian and Pacific Islander American Heritage Month. So to recognize our Asian and Pacific Islander American identified community, KBOO will be airing all Asian and Pacific Islander programming from 8 a.m. until 4 p.m. on Friday, May 3rd. That day, we'll be airing features from your favorite API KBOO programmers. Tune in to hear episodes of Lip Fantastic, APA Compass, DMA Roberts award-winning series, Crossing East, and an all-new Pacific Underground and music playlist by Sun Lee and DJ Diablo. That's Asian and Pacific Islander American Heritage Day, Friday, May 3rd from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. For more information and program schedule, just go to our website at kboo.fm.
Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
My name is Joseph Galavan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Grace Cook Anderson. She's here from the Portland Art Museum, where she's the Arlene and Harold Schnitzer Curator of Northwest Art, to talk about The Map Is Not the Territory, a regional Northwest show that closes on Sunday, May the 5th. Thanks for coming back to KBOO, Grace.
Thanks for having me, Joseph. Good to be here.
So this is a survey. You kind of expanded the idea of the Northwest to Alaska and BC.
I did, for this iteration.
And so you went out and found all these artists and basically put them in a room together. And it's kind of like the old biennial, but you're going to have this every 3 years, correct?
Yes. I feel like I need a year to do studio visits and that a little bit of extra time to think through the process. So 3 years feels more manageable to me mm-hmm. than every
and,
2 years.
And when you started this, did you already have a title, The Map Is Not the Territory?
No, the title came almost at the end. And it came through discussions with artists. This specific title came with the help of Marianne Peters, who was kind of sitting on it. Who's one of the artists, sitting on it as a way to think about her own work. But she was very generous to share it with me, and I asked if I could use it for the exhibition title because it fit in with so many of what the artists were working on. So it came in toward the end.
So it sort of applied to everyone, and it what does it say to you, the title, immediately?
It did. It came at the end, and I think each artist has interpreted it in quite a different way. But for me, I liked the playfulness of the language. The map is not the territory. It felt very visual to me, and it's something that I felt like many people could relate to, just on a very visual level. But too, also thinking about the ambiguity of what does the Northwest mean, just in that immediacy, I liked the sort of challenge of that, and also sort of where we are today in thinking around our borders, in thinking about the migration crisis, in thinking about climate change. There are real no borders, and yet there is an insistence on such borders. So I thought it was a really appropriate title.
And did they respond to the title, or was the work being made anyway, or it was already done by the time they got the title?
A little bit of both. I think for me, one of the things I emphasized with this was I didn't want to impose a theme. It was really, I talk about this sort of generative process where I did all the studio visits, met with artists, and was really thinking about what were the themes that were sort of sticking, what were the conversations that were kind of haunting me and staying with me, and what artists did keep popping up. And with that, we shared reading material together throughout the exhibition preparation. We were in vulnerable spaces together, sharing our processes, our ways of thinking, and specific reading that was sort of inspiring our process. And so in that way, I think each artist was really thinking about it in terms of how that title applies in their own work and also their complete own interpretation of it. Mm-hmm. So in Fernanda D'Agostino's case, she's really thinking about these direct borders very much related to current events today. In Rob Rees's case, he's really thinking about the very conceptual nature of what is a vessel, what is on the inside, what is on the outside. But that then becomes a metaphor for many other things, our body of place, of the land.
Fernanda D'Agostino's piece is a video piece as you go into the sculpture course. So she got the big rooms, like prime real estate. There are two big fabric screens that kind of look like curtains, you know, like, what do you call those curtains these days? We used to call them net curtains.
Yeah, sort of scrims.
Yeah, and the video is projected onto them and through them and onto the next wall. The piece is called Borderline, and it's video usually of one or two or sometimes more women kind of dancing. They're kind of writhing around. And then there's other stuff projected on them, like there are patterns of water and sky, and then sometimes there's fire all over them, and it's a really beautiful piece. You could watch it, you know, it's just very mesmerizing, and the fact that it's on this soft screen, it keeps moving around, it's beautiful. Oh, and there is another bit projected on the floor.
Yes, yeah.
Do you know why it's called Borderline?
I do know why. And you're right, it is in prime real estate. I think it was a great advantage, but also quite a great challenge that Fernanda so graciously took on. And for me, there's some technical aspects in the, placing video work requires much more controlled light levels or less light levels. So it had to be removed from the other spaces. But in this case, with Fernanda in particular, I liked the idea of having that in the courtyard as sort of a beginning introduction and also a conclusion to think about the exhibition. Because, as you say, it is sort of a montage of the figures and the landscapes and also the nuclear images of border crossings, of people crossing the border that Fernanda had procured from open source images from the U.S. government. And what Fernanda has created was using a software, all of these images shuffle and combine in over 100 variations so that one's experience is never the same.
How long is the loop?
It's not a loop, it's a software. Okay. So it's always changing and shuffling and offering different moments. And when the border crossing images occur, the camera, there's two cameras that captures the viewers walking through the space. So we become inserted into that landscape and the border crossing. So I think Fernanda was really commenting on the crisis of migration throughout Europe, throughout the U.S.-Mexico border. She talks specifically about, as with the appointment of Trump and the crisis between U.S. and Mexico border really kind of taking the forefront in many conversations. And then also kind of the larger aspect of a lot of these issues as a result of climate change, families being displaced in their homes and having to move. So she's speaking to a lot of those issues. But with the figures also, they are responding to these images. In a lot of ways, it's how the body takes on trauma of migration, forced migration, trauma of immigration, trauma of climate change. And these are all kind of things that we take on in our bodies as well. So they are a reflection of that.
Do you know, when she was making it, were the dancers in a studio with light projected on them? Did it look like that, or did they just dance and then she edited it all together?
Oh, that's a great question. I think my understanding, I could be completely wrong, but in earlier conversations that I remember, I think Fernanda had shown the images of the different kind of montages and the dancers were responding to those images. And then they also respond to one another. The dancers respond to one another. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't so much the overall projection in that way, I think. Mm-hmm. But they also were part of the performance at the museum, so they were also performing in the space, responding to the entire installation as well, which added another amazing sort of presence and mood to the whole installation.
Mm-hmm. Henry Chang has a piece. It's a video. It's just a darkened room with a couple of benches, and it's a projection. And the projector's at kind of knee level, so you keep walking through it. People keep blacking it out. And it's a video of the weather. Columbia meets the ocean. And it's a very low slung landscape, kind of marshy and not really much going on. And then there's this strange ticker through the middle of text, which you can read. It's quite hard to read because it's not, doesn't contrast very well. And it's all about basically the locals losing their land in a treaty in 1851, the Chinook people. And it seems like he's just panning the landscape back and forth, or maybe in a circle.
Yes, it's a 360 view of Tansy Point. And Tansy Point is the land that's kind of located between Fort Stevens and Astoria. So it's mm-hmm. this
it's that
area.
Pointy bit that's like the northernmost part of Oregon.
Yes, yeah. And so Henry was very... I really appreciated Henry's approach. And he's been interested in Chinook jargon since the 1990s. He's done projects around using Chinook jargon.
Sorry, Chinook what?
Chinook jargon.
Jargon?
Yeah.
What, like?
So Chinook jargon was a language that was used for trade primarily. So I think it was about 60 words, so that different tribes, different people could come together and actually have a dialogue. Mm-hmm. And it's initially sort of a trade language. But with Henry felt very strongly that this project certainly could not be done with the help of the Chinook Nation, and particularly with Tony Johnson, who is the narrator, who's the voice. And the text, you have to stand and obstruct the landscape in order to be able to read the text. So you have to block the projection with your body, and the text becomes more legible. And the beginning part of the text is not long after 1851, the failure of that treaty, the reflection of the failure of that treaty. And then there is a brief pause, and then the second text is Tony Johnson representing the Chinook voice and reflecting on the failure of that moment, and the Chinook people's good faith, but the U.S. government not following through, to this day, not following through. And the voice is Tony's, you know, beautiful voice narrating as the landscape goes over this 360 view. And that land is still up. So if you go to the Chinook Nation site, they're trying to raise funds to purchase that land for their people. And that is an effort still being done. So I think it's great. It was wonderful for Tony to walk Henry through this process and offer a very close engagement and his knowledge and his expertise, and for Henry to pursue it and to shed a contemporary light on this issue that's very relevant.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Grace Cook Anderson. She's here from the Portland Art Museum talking about The Map, It's Not the Territory. And that show closes on Sunday, May the 5th, 2019. There are 8 artists in this, so you really can bomb through the whole thing and sometimes not know who's who. You know, they kind of overlap in some places. But one of the most striking ones, I think, is Charlene Vickers. She has these series of spears leaning against the walls, sort of hand-whittled spikes, wooden stakes. And then she has these turtles that look like they're made of polystyrene. They look like brown wood something you'd buy in a gift shop, but they're really big and they're in a kind of sequence, sort of walking or swimming together. Just tell us, what does the turtle mean to her?
Yeah, so Charlene Vickers, she's based in Vancouver, BC, but she is an Ojibwe. She's Ojibwe, but also, I think for her, living in Vancouver.
That's Northern Ontario.
Yes.
Right.
But also, what does it mean for an Ojibwe artist to have lived off her, you know, outside of her land, her homeland, for 20 years? And where does that sense of place come from? And it comes from within her. So I think a lot of that is thinking about her ancestry, her family, the generations of women, particularly the Indigenous women. I think a lot of her work is focused on healing Indigenous women and celebrating Indigenous women. So the turtles are sort of these beautiful healers. They're guiding.
Mm-hmm.
They're these sort of guiders. And the diviner spears, you can really see Charlene's hand. I mean, she describes herself primarily as a painter, but she's certainly very much a maker of all sorts. And then these also become props for her performance.
Right. So she did a performance in the gallery, right?
Where she
used these divining rods to find things.
She used the divining spears, yes, and particularly the cedar spears. And what's so great is when you get close to them, you can smell the cedar. They have a really powerful presence. And she used them in a number of different ways, the spear as transforming into these different sources, as a row for a boat, as a carrier, as a weapon, all of these things that also empower, can empower you and offer this sort of transformative place. So she did a performance with those spears, mm-hmm, as well.
So she does things like at the Seattle Art Fair, she had this cone megaphone, but it was like one of those jingle dresses, and she performed it. She said she made it without knowing how she was going to do the performance. And
yes,
then just her and her friend went around the art fair, and they did it four times and just talked about it. Sounds very kind of improvised.
Yes, I think there is a bit of improvisation, but I think she's also very humble in how she talks about her own work and her sort of process. But I love those cones, and again, the cone takes on multiple possibilities. They become a hearing device, a projection device to speak out to her grandmother or to her elders, out to the spirit world. They become a sort of a celebratory kind of marker. They take on different meanings.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a playfulness to them too. What I love about those is that they're made of cardboard. They're really quite humble. They bend. They're kind of bent at the ends when she's kind of uses them to stomp on, you know, make rhythms and stomp on. And you see their sort of wear and tear, but that also becomes part of the piece.
Mm-hmm. And she has another piece, which is a circle of chairs. Each one has moccasins made from beer carton cardboard, like a case of beer. Took the cardboard, sewed it into little pieces, and made moccasins. And there are also blankets. And that is, in a way, it's a bit like the work of another artist there, Marianne Peters. She has these impossible monuments, like a fishing net full of clothes and things like abandoned by migrants. Like there's a phone case in there. It feels like it's a very, very private language that they're working in. And how does the viewer get access to that?
I think, to me, the exhibition as a whole feels very tactile. There's a lot of different mediums. I think you can really feel the artist's hand in a lot of the objects. And you know, on the it's not a heavily didactic exhibition, but each section the artist speaks in their own voice about the work, and it provides a lot of information from for Charlene, it stems from this very personal narrative about Indigenous women and healing. In Marianne's case, too, again, it stems from her own background as Lebanese Syrian ancestry and being affected by the Syrian refugee crisis. And I think the public really gets it. Maybe if not literally, I think they at least feel the intentions of the works, or they feel the hand of the artist. I really believe that. And I've gotten so many comments about Charlene Vickers' Sleepwalking, about how haunting that piece feels, even though they might not know necessarily all the literal meanings or the deepest intentions of Charlene, but they can understand the feel of it.
And the chairs with the moccasins and the blankets.
Yes, yeah.
And the most spectacular piece, I would think, is the most spectacular sculpture is Annette Bellamy's Moving Mountains, which is kind of pyramid of, I think, like maybe 100 stones. And they look like, it says they're stoneware, so maybe they are real stones. They're heavy. No.
It's ceramic.
Hanging by fishing wire. So it's like this exploded view of a pyramid, and they're just stones hanging in the air. And they are stone? What are they?
No, they're stoneware. So it's like a low-fired ceramic. So they're quite light. They're like these sort of pods. But they really capture what feels like rocks and pebbles.
Yeah, they look
and,
like river rocks.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, so Annette is based in Halibut Cove, Alaska. And she's been a fisherwoman for over 45 years, a commercial fisherwoman. And so half the year she has this very demanding work schedule, and then the other half of the year she has this moment of solitude where she really spends a lot of time in her studio, and she primarily works in ceramics. So Moving Mountains is really about being affected so directly by her landscape, and thinking about the mountain as a very much this entire ecological structure that lives and breathes and heaves along with us. It's not a static thing, but it's a very much a living being. And so when you stand in the space, it is a very captivating sculpture installation, and it offers this sort of meditative quality too. But it moves ever so subtly. You can see the stones kind of sort of spinning very quietly or moving very slowly. And again, it's in reaction to the viewers. It's in reaction to the air in the space. It's not a still piece.
Mm-hmm. Jenny Irene Miller has a series of photos, so 22 prints called Continuous. And it's LGBTQ2+ people from, where is she from?
She's from Anchorage, and she's an Inupiaq artist. And
what's 2+?
Two-spirit.
Everyone at KBOO knows that, just checking.
Yeah, so, you know, we have some very hard themes in this exhibition, and certainly they are not things, you know, I don't claim to make a statement or a hard case. I only ask to sort of invite people to really think about critically some of these issues. And the entry point is through these beautiful works of art that these artists have all made. So, and one of them is certainly centering Indigenous values and making efforts toward decolonization. And Jenny Irene Miller, what I love so much about her work is, as a young artist, she is doing this in such a wise and gentle way. And it's also, again, stems from her own identity and coming to terms with colonization of sexuality within her own Indigenous people. So how can she create a work that will not only support and help her Indigenous community find a voice, but it also has become sort of this educational tool and a reminder for elders who see these beautiful portraits, mm-hmm. and can recall moments of two-spirit and moments of gender fluidity within their own people before colonization.
Each one has a little bio. You can read them on a sort of laminated card, which I think really helps because are they medium format photos? They're square. It's kind of Instagram-y, but they're very beautifully produced prints.
Yeah, they're not square, but I can see what you mean. And they're very much. What Jenny will do is she will ask to photograph each person and then capture their stories. And everyone has a story. Everyone has. We all have something to learn from everybody. So I think it's really wonderful that she gives all of these people a voice, a very personal voice, and we get to look into each and everyone's eyes in these photographs.
We have to skip over these two, but Rob Ree and Ryan Pierce. Ryan is a painter. You'll see his paintings. A lot of them are of plants, but in strange locations like sheds with broken windows, that kind of thing. And then Rob Ree has these plaster sculptures. Some of them are gourd shaped, some are like water bottle, and they're kind of strewn along the floor on a little dais. It's all white. It's like very unfinished, but a lot of it's broken.
Yes. So yeah, really quickly, Ryan Pierce is really thinking about this sort of narrative of what does a near future look like, sort of a recognizable future, but also one that is more dramatically affected by climate change. And also thinking about the curse of our Western civilization, our attempts to gather and collect and categorize things, on one hand to this kind of approach to understand, but on another hand to completely destroy the very indigenous place. And as a result, we're all sort of cursed, you know. So he has these beautiful sort of back narratives with these paintings that you don't necessarily need to know the stories of, but the paintings sort of reveal the aftermath. And then with Rob Ree, yes, again, on one side of the wall, there are these sort of vessels, and they stem from earlier sculptures where he creates these steel frames, and within the frames he grows these gourds. He sends them out to farmers in Eastern Washington and Southern California, and it takes about 6 to 10 seeds before one will actually grow and really kind of morph within these confined structures. And so to me they also speak about resilience and these known or unknown sort of oppressions. But he also, too, is very much playing about that inside and outside. What informs, does what's outside tell you the what's inside, and vice versa, and the play of those objects. So on the other side, the marginalia installation are all of these molds taken from within these things, and they take on fossil images of fossils, or they have a lot of organic kind of feels to them. But again, it is sort of playing with that idea of boundaries and borders and assumptions of what we know or don't know.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like you have a fabulous job. You get to go see artists, but it's more like doing a 3-year degree, right? You talk to them, you write to them, you read things together, and, you know, it's sort of paying great respect.
Oh, I love that idea. Yeah, yeah. No, it's quite an ideal job, I have to say. And I love that. This was quite an experiment in some ways, because I really asked the artists to come along with me and figure things out with me, and they have all been so generous and amazing to work with. And the other thing I love about my job is the artists stay with you in your life. They stay with you for years and years, and mm-hmm. you follow their work.
My name's Joseph Galvin. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Grace Cook Anderson. She's the curator of Northwest Art at the Portland Art Museum. She was talking about The Map Is Not the Territory, which closes Sunday, May the 5th. Thanks for coming back to KBOO, Grace.
Thanks so much for having me.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
The The KBOO Development Committee meets the first Wednesday of each month at 4:30 p.m. and is looking for new members. Work on the committee includes evaluating and implementing fundraising and outreach strategies, developing and strengthening partnerships and collaborations, and advocating for KBOO in the community. If you are interested in joining the committee, contact Development Director Allison Kolb at allison@kboo.org to learn more. Meetings are held at KBOO, located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Please call the station at 503-231-8032 prior to the meeting to confirm that it is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Pete Seeger Tribute and 100th Birthday Celebration on Friday, May 3rd from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. The 6th annual Pete Seeger Tribute is a family-friendly sing-along event that features Lauren Sheehan, Peter Hayes, Ben Davis, Bill Merlin, and many more. Again, that's the Portland Pete Seeger Tribute and 100th Birthday Celebration on Friday, May 3rd from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.